And yes, thank you, Anthony, for introducing my new Indian style jacket. It's actually the first time, apart from wearing the uniform of the white Curtas here when I visit, it's the first time in 33 years of visiting India that I've had a tailor-made Indian style jacket. And I really like it. It was done in, it was actually quite expensive. It was done in a shop that a sister took me to in Ahmedabad. I don't like buying clothes, it's not my scene. But she insisted that I come and order something from this shop. And from the price, I hoped that Harry Potter style, it might actually allow me to speak Hindi. But it doesn't. So, and Dr. M.H. Mehta was warning me that because of my English, half of you may not understand me too well, because especially if I speak too fast. So if I am speaking too fast, just signal to me to slow down, because I have a bit of a tendency to get moving and forget to make sure that you're with me. The other thing is that, which is, would also be nice if I did speak Hindi, is that what I'm going to be sharing is really quite revolutionary. It really is. Even within, it's actually a hark back to what your ancient Vedas used to teach, that mind is primary and the material world is a kind of projection of mind. But that is the territory that scientists at the frontiers are now moving into. And it's very hard for us to grasp, because this material world so dominates our brains. We're attuned to form a picture of the world through our senses, through all the programming and conditioning inside our brains, and actually to bypass that is the essence of Raja Yoga. And to be able to take your mind beyond all your conditioning, even beyond thinking, although you can think to get yourself to this other space, is really the goal. And it's that, the connection between your consciousness and the highest consciousness, which is unchanged through time, that actually restores the truth inside you that will allow Satyoga to come and allow you to emerge the future deity that you've been hearing about. So this is actually a beautiful explanation of how we are going to get from deep Kaliyug, in which we sit now with so much sorrow and suffering and difficulty and everything moving into critical stage, how we get from there to Satyug. It's actually incredibly easy. It's a thought away, but you can't catch that as long as you have the materialistic model in your head, which almost all of us have actually deep inside us. So with those introductory remarks, I will now move on with my presentation. Now, I don't want to frighten you, but really, I'm on a journey of discovery myself. When I came across the BKs about a little over 30 years ago, I was working as a science correspondent in the newspapers in the UK, and I had a very strong hope and faith in science as being a better way of getting information about the world than senses and feelings and mystical practices, because I felt all of those had misled us somehow, that they weren't reliable. You had one lot of people saying, God's telling me to invade your country, another lot of people saying, God's telling me to do this to you. And it just didn't make any sense to me. Science seemed to me to get nice, clean information, you know, just rational and tangible and measurable. But soon, working especially in the health and medicine area, I realized that science also, despite being able to give you some very reliable information about very small aspects of matter, there's a bit of a chat going on. It's just there, sorry, yeah. Despite the... thank you. Despite the science giving you that very reliable information about small pieces of information, such as the level of your blood pressure or your blood cholesterol, medical science has not been very good at describing to you why your blood pressure should be raised or why your blood cholesterol has gone up. and it would tend to put you into a category, you have raised blood pressure. Actually, perhaps your blood pressure went up for very good reasons, because you had a lot to cope with at the time. And like a heating system that needs to do a lot, the pressure increases to get more blood flowing through the system, more energy to the brain. And we interfere with that sometimes at our peril, I can tell you. So that came home to me through working closely with medical science, especially, that the dynamics in our life, that the consciousness with which we approach life is incredibly important. And this is another way of saying the same as Sister Shivani has been telling you, that thought is cause, experience is effect. Thought is cause, thought is primary. Thought is the cause of your experience. And if you don't like the effects in your life, you have to change the nature of your thinking. But that is quite a big task, because our thinking is hardwired into neural pathways in our brains. That's why meditative practice that takes you beyond the brain into a territory of purer truth is so incredibly important. But science now is actually telling us why that is so important and how it works, which is very, very exciting, but it's also quite astonishing. Deepak Chopra and Dr. Rudolf Tanzi, who's professor of neurology at Harvard, they authored a paper in the Huffington Post, the online newspaper, about two or three years ago, called "Good News, You Are Not Your Brain." And that was where the title of this talk came from. But they had this bit, "Good News, You Are Not Your Brain," with this very issue in mind, that our brains carry so much conditioning from our society, from our friends, from our family, some of it good and helpful, some of it unhelpful, but subconscious. So we're compelled to do things we don't quite know why. So they actually were challenging the assumption shared by 99% of neuroscientists that we are our brains. And they were presenting evidence that we're not our brains, which actually some scientists believe is so compelling that they believe that we should enter now an era which they call post-materialist science. Post-materialist science is addressing the reality of the mental nature of this universe, that thought is primary, and what happens outside of us in the material world, including our brains, is secondary to that mental component. This is a huge shift for us to make, even in this country, which is the home of spiritual understanding. Flaws in that reasoning that we are our brains, this was just some points that Deepak Chopra and Rudolf Tanzi set out. Brain activity isn't the same as thinking, feeling or seeing. Your brain may be doing all these different processes which you can look at under the modern scanning equipment, but that isn't the same as the experience. Even the colour red you could not possibly describe from watching all of the neuronal changes and electrical activity in the brain. You would have no experience of red from that. Secondly, no one has remotely shown how molecules, the brain, acquire the qualities of mind. Thirdly, it's impossible to construct a theory of the mind based on material objects that somehow became conscious. And yet that is the predominant neuroscientific point of view, that somehow through billions of years of evolutionary development, first, complex life forms began, simple life forms began like amoeba, and they gradually became more complex until eventually you got brains and then a mind that emerged from those billions of years of development. That is absolutely false, according to this post-materialist science. And it's unreasonable, as this article was pointing out. They're saying it's more like when the brain lights up, because these modern scanning techniques show you which parts of the brain are being used according to the tasks you're doing. It's not that activity is causing the experience. It's more like you are playing the music, which your radio then actually allows you to hear. The radio didn't compose the music. Your brain did not compose your thoughts. One of the papers that was cited in this very, very challenging article in the Huffington Post was by Professor Donald Hoffman. He sets out a theory, and it's a beautiful, beautifully expressed, but rather complex theory, that really in this world, we are living a bit, you know, the virtual reality machines that are constructed and amusement arcades and things like that, where you're immersed in something which seems very real to you while you're playing the game, but actually it's all a construction of the computer. He's suggesting that something really quite similar, only far more complex, is going on, and that we are conscious agents. We are minds that shape reality, including the brain. Our mind is what actually shapes what goes on in our brain, not the other way around. Are you with me so far? This is the assertion of this, is a central assertion of this different way of thinking. It's supported in a way by one of the discoveries in neuroscience, that our brains are much more plastic than used to be thought the case. They change with every thought and feeling that we have. This is actually, even only 20 years ago, they thought that your personality, most of aspects of your functioning were pretty well fixed by the time you were in your late teens. Now they know that's not the case. You can have there was a study done on a group of biotechnology company workers who were known to have low morale, and they had higher activity in a group of neurons known to be connected with low feelings. And they were given an 8-week course of mindfulness meditation, and in just 8 weeks, they shifted from a predominance of the brain activity associated with depressed, low morale feelings to a predominance of brain activity in the left frontal cortex associated with positive feelings. So according to the way you use your brain changes to help you use it in that way. It's not that you are a victim of your brain. This book by this New York psychiatrist, Norman Doidge, very good review of the current developments in brain scientists, all sorts of marvellous insights into the brain that have been provided by neuroscientists, but it betrays a key mistake in the title, The Brain That Changes Itself. As Norman Doidge says, we've yet to understand how thoughts change brain structure, but it's clear that they do. But the title, The Brain That Changes Itself, betrays the idea that you are your brain and somehow you have the capacity within you to change your own brain. Not true. You are actually, in the language you've been hearing here, you are a soul. You have a brain. It's when you understand that you're a soul, a conscious agent, that's what gives you the power to start to choose how you choose your brain and not be a victim of all the conditioning that is in your brain arising from your past. Unbelievably powerful shift to make in your thinking, and remembering that changing your thinking is what really changes the experience and results in your life, as Shivani has been telling us. Quantum mechanics. I discovered only two or three years ago, when I was looking into this subject with more intensity than I had done in the past, that 80 years ago, at least, quantum mechanics, which is a branch of physics that is fully accepted as the most fundamental description of reality, a deeper description of reality than classical physics, Newtonian physics, as it's sometimes called, action and reaction physics, quantum mechanics describes the world of the very small, subatomic particles, an interplay of very refined forces. And one of the amazing things about it is that it involves consciousness directly. Consciousness or mind and matter at that very refined level are inextricable. Most scientists backed away from this discovery and said, okay, we'll take the useful mathematics of quantum mechanics and use them in our technologies, because it's helped us make things like lasers and microprocessors, many, many refined understandings that have brought some of the miracles of modern science to us. But they backed away from this extraordinary discovery from 80 years back that mind and matter are inextricably linked at that very refined, tiny level. Because it was such a challenge to the materialistic idea that basically we're material beings who have evolved over billions of years and who now have brains that perceive the world. Such a deep challenge to that. The other thing is that quantum mechanics shows that whether something is manifesting as a particle or a wave, because part of the discovery in quantum mechanics is that a particle only appears when it is observed, when an observer comes in, and it appears to be present because an observer has actually made an act of observation. Until then, it's described by a mathematical term called the wave function, which gives a whole range of possibilities, huge range of possibilities, of where that particle might be if you go in to look for it. It's very mathematically determined, but there is no particle until a conscious observer actually comes and looks. So mind is bringing matter into being at that very deep level. Here we have a Sri Ram, if you can get this to run, just a sec, hold it for one moment. Here we have a little bit of light relief, I hope, from some of what I'm sharing. This is from a movie called What the Bleep, and it's Dr. Quantum comes. Dr. Quantum is this imaginary teacher, professor, and he is going to demonstrate something called the double slit experiment, which the readers of one physics journal voted the most important physics experiment of all time. Of all time. This simple double slit experiment. It actually demonstrates this, what I've been speaking of, this interrelationship between mind and matter. And then the interpretation of that we'll discuss after we've watched the movie. It's just 4 or 5 minutes.
And here we are, the granddaddy of all quantum weirdness, the infamous double slit experiment. To understand this experiment, we first need to see how particles, or little balls of matter, act. If we randomly shoot a small object, say a marble, at the screen, we see a pattern on the back wall where they went through the slit and hit. Now, if we add a second slit, we would expect to see a second band duplicated to the right. Now, let's look at waves. The waves hit the slit and radiate out, striking the back wall with the most intensity directly in line with the slit. The line of brightness on the back screen shows that intensity. This is similar to the line the marbles make. But when we add the second slit, something different happens. If the top of one wave meets the bottom of another wave, they cancel each other out. So now, there is an interference pattern on the back wall. Places where the two tops meet are the highest intensity, the bright lines, and where they cancel, there is nothing. So, when we throw things, that is, matter, through two slits, we get this. Two bands of hits. And with waves, we get an interference pattern of many bands. Good so far. Now, let's go quantum. An electron is a tiny, tiny bit of matter, like a tiny marble. Let's fire a stream through one slit. It behaves just like the marble, a single band. So, if we shoot these tiny bits through two slits, we should get, like the marbles, two bands. What? An interference pattern. We fired electrons, tiny bits of matter, through. But we get a pattern like waves, not like little marbles. How? How could pieces of matter create an interference pattern like a wave? It doesn't make sense. But physicists are clever. They thought, maybe those little balls are bouncing off each other and creating that pattern. So, they decide to shoot electrons through one at a time. There is no way they could interfere with each other. But after an hour of this, the same interference pattern is seen to emerge. The conclusion is inescapable. The single electron leaves as a particle, becomes a wave of potentials, goes through both slits, and interferes with itself to hit the wall like a particle. But mathematically, it's even stranger. It goes through both slits, and it goes through neither. And it goes through just one, and it goes through just the other. All of these possibilities are in superposition with each other. But physicists were completely baffled by this. So they decided to peek and see which slit it actually goes through. They put a measuring device by one slit to see which one it went through and let it fly. But the quantum world is far more mysterious than they could have imagined. When they observed, the electron went back to behaving like a little marble. It produced a pattern of two bands, not an interference pattern of many. The very act of measuring or observing which slit it went through meant it only went through one, not both. The electron decided to act differently, as though it was aware it was being watched. And it was here that physicists stepped forever into the strange, never world of quantum events. What is matter? Marbles or waves? And waves of what? And what does an observer have to do with any of this? The observer collapsed the wave function simply by observing.
So I hope now you're more confused than ever, perhaps. It's rather amazing, isn't it? This would not be challenged by any physicists. What you've just seen is an accurate representation of the facts of the matter. The interpretation is something else. And the interpretation that most physicists have given is that it's just confusing. There's a quote from one famous physicist that anyone who says they understand quantum mechanics obviously doesn't. And yet, in my view, from having studied this, the reason for that confusion is that physicists, being material scientists primarily, wedded to the view that this is a material world and that mind is just something that comes from the brain, that's the conventional view that most of us live with, even those of us who might talk of the soul, but we actually think of ourselves deep inside. Most of the time we're thinking of ourselves as physical beings. And that is what creates the confusion. If you can go with me now in experimenting with a different way of thinking of yourself, you might see some glimmer of light, which also helps to answer some of the questions that were coming up yesterday. How can we get from deep Kaliyug into Satyug? How could this old world that is so overpopulated and with so many problems, how could that turn into a golden age? How can I, with all the kind of negative sanskars that I might bring, how can I change myself so that I'm really like a deity again in my consciousness? These answers to these questions come from this deep understanding that is frontier science is trying to offer us. Now look, Max Planck, the father of quantum physics. There are Max Planck institutes all over the world. He is the number one creator of that extraordinary, powerful field known as quantum mechanics. What does Max Planck say? All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force. We must assume behind this force is the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind. This mind, or consciousness, is the matrix of all matter. That is a huge challenge to the world of physics, and they have not faced up to that challenge. Einstein said something similar. Einstein was quite resistant to some of the findings in quantum mechanics, but he also came to this conclusion that everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble. Here's another quote from Sir James Jeans, 1930, when quantum mechanics was being established. Nobody talks this way. You can see any BBC science programme you like, probably the same to a considerable extent here in India too, that they don't actually embrace the possibility that our fundamental paradigm, our fundamental worldview is wrong in thinking that matter is primary in this world. Sir James Jeans, he was a physicist and a mathematician. The stream of knowledge is heading towards a non-mechanical reality. The universe begins to look more like a great thought than a great machine. Mind no longer appears as an accidental intruder into the realm of matter. We are beginning to suspect that we ought rather to hail it as a creator and governor of the realm of matter. And all of this is absolutely consistent with the findings in quantum theory. To my great interest, it was actually one of the people here, a retired major, a few years back, he put into my hands a book by Dr. Paul Brunton called The Wisdom of the Overself. Paul Brunton spent years, back in the 30s, early 40s, spent many years in the East. He was an English scientist. But he came out to the East and he met many of the sages and saints from many different traditions. And he pulled their findings together into a series of books, the essence of which is given here. Life has planted us in a universe of thoughts, which we have mistakenly taken to be a universe of matter. The whole thing is an appearance in consciousness, like this virtual reality idea. The world, which seems presented from outside to the senses, is actually projected from within by the mind. David Bohm and Basil Hiley, two very, very distinguished British physicists, more recent, although David Bohm has now died. The deeper reality is something beyond either mind or matter. The notion of separateness is an abstraction valid for only certain limited purposes. One could say that through the human being, the universe is making a mirror to observe itself. If you want a deep answer to the question of what is the purpose of life, I think it might lie within that statement. That the universe is making a mirror through the human being and through all life to make a mirror to observe itself. There is no real division between mind and matter, psyche and soma. Even an electron has a rudimentary mental pole represented by the quantum potential. The observer, along with his thoughts, is contained in an inseparable way. So now, some very up-to-date evidence pointing in the same direction, but it's instead of being theoretical, because most of what I've shown you so far is from theoretical physicists who are facing up to the reality of what quantum mechanics has been telling them. But more recently, there have been a string of personal anecdotes pointing in the same direction. This was a very fine book that went international in its appeal, Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife, Dr. Evan Alexander. He had a viral infection of his frontal cortex. It put him in a coma for 10 days. In other words, his brain function was wiped out during that period. And he moved into this incredible realm where he felt as if he was still totally conscious, but it was a blissful experience. And when they finally brought him back into waking consciousness, he demanded notebook and pen to write these extraordinary experiences and turned it into a best-selling book. He's passionate about these findings. I was encountering the reality of a world of consciousness that existed completely free of the limitations of my physical brain. My experience showed me that the death of the body and the brain are not the end of consciousness. See how important this is for our understanding of who we are, that we're not our brains. Consciousness continues. Consciousness is on a continuum. You do not finish when this body finishes. This is another one, a brain scientist in the US. She had a hemorrhage in her left hemisphere that gradually she lost all her left hemispheric function, a kind of stroke, but there was bleeding. And it was very confusing to her, because the left hemisphere of the brain mainly deals with numbers and rationality, and she couldn't recognise numbers on the phone to try and call for help. It was very distressing for a while. But then, again, she found herself released into some realm that was beyond the brain. And this was a description from her book, My Stroke of Insight. I am the life force power of the universe. I am the life force power of the 50 trillion beautiful molecular geniuses that make up my form. She means the 50 trillion cells that make up the body. At one with all that is, and that at oneness is an extraordinarily important aspect of all of this. Again, the near-death experience. Probably you've heard about this. Actually, some people believe it should be called the death experience because people die. But then, thanks to modern resuscitation techniques, they're brought back into the body. There's argument about this, but actually, those who've studied it most intensely say, no, these people die because it can be shown that there's no heartbeat, there's no breathing. Sometimes it's shown that there's no electrical activity in the brain. The person has gone, but then after minutes and in some cases after hours, resuscitation brings them back. And quite often they have this extraordinary story to tell of when they were dead. That again, their consciousness continues. This is a summary by Dr. Pim van Lommel, who did an extensive study of the near-death experience in Holland. He was a young cardiologist when one of his patients had this experience. He managed to resuscitate them, and they described this incredible feeling that when they were dead, they were more alive. And then they were almost a kind of reluctance to come back into the body. And he wrote it off as just because he was conventionally trained. He wrote it off as perhaps the death throes of a dying brain, but a hallucination of some sort. But later he started reading about more of these stories, and he set up a study in Holland. It lasted for several years. 5 hospitals were involved, many of his colleagues. They pulled in all the stories of people who were resuscitated in these circumstances, who died and then come back. About 300 cases over the period of the study, and just over a fifth of them recalled in this great detail this continuity of consciousness and the pattern of the near-death experience. This is his summary. Enveloped by light, people experience total acceptance and unconditional love and have access to a deep knowledge and wisdom with indescribable clarity and insight. It's so interesting to me that the descriptions of the soul that I was given when I first met the Brahma Kumaris back in London 33 years ago, which I couldn't understand at all, I was told almost the same, that the soul is love, the soul is peace, the soul is wisdom. And you have to sort of still your mind, still your brain, in order to be able to experience this beauty in meditation. This is the essence of what Raja Yoga is about. It's not an imaginary thing. It's not just something that feels nice. It's an access to a truth that we all need to know about. Here are some quotes from Pim van Lommel's book, which, by the way, it's called Consciousness Beyond Life. It's a first-class book because during the period of the study, he also brought himself up to date with this frontier science. He refers to non-local space, which is like a zone which is outside space-time. Normally, as you know, we exist in the 3 dimensions of space and the 1 of time. We call this play that we're in space-time. There is this non-local space that is outside that. But these quotes, the pinnacle of everything there is, of energy, of love especially, of warmth, of beauty, it seemed as if time and distance didn't exist. You see, outside time, outside space, I was everywhere at once, and sometimes my attention was focused on something, and I was there too. And I like this quote from one of the experiencers: I think death is a really nasty, bad lie. That's worth remembering, especially as we approach leaving this body. Pim van Lommel argues that we can all access that beautiful realm. We just forget that we have that capacity, because we get in our brain, physical portion of existence, our brain sort of blocks out that larger cosmic background. So again, this fits so beautifully with what Daddy Janki used to tell me in London. Oh, she was always telling me, don't think, Neville. Stop thinking. Think less. She was always telling me this because I thought too much. And as long as I'm in my brain with all that thinking, I'm not going to be able to access that deeper truth. So our brain blocks out or veils this larger, just as the sun's light blocks the stars from view each morning. Now, this was a recent study, just actually a couple of years ago in Oxford, with the drug psilocybin, which used to be known by the hippies of Wales. It's an active ingredient in magic mushrooms, as they used to call them. These little tiny little mushrooms. The hippies found that if you kind of fried a few of them, or they eat them raw sometimes as well, that it would give you a trip, like a mind-expanding trip. And because this was back in the 60s, but because the authorities got quite concerned about the druggy culture of that time with the hippies and the flower children and everything, they thought people were dropping out too much. So there was actually a kind of bar on studying consciousness, and especially these wider aspects of it. And scientists were not allowed to research drugs like psilocybin for some time. But because now in this last 10, 15 years, consciousness studies have been coming to the fore in science, there's greater, more liberal approach. In Oxford, they gave measured doses of psilocybin to a group of volunteers, students. Probably didn't have difficulty finding the volunteers because quite a nice thing to try. And they measured what was happening in their brains using fMRI. That's functional magnetic resonance imaging. It's a kind of giant hairdryer that actually picks up what's happening in different parts of your brain. It's the big tool that has allowed modern neuroscience to really peer inside the brain as we use the brain. And they wanted to find out which parts of the brain will light up, producing these cosmic experiences. And to their surprise, they found that no parts of the brain lit up, but what they call these key connector hubs shut down. I love their summary. This is from the summary of their paper. These results strongly imply that the subjective effects of psychedelic drugs, that's mind-expanding drugs, are caused by decreased activity and connectivity in the brain's key connector hubs, enabling a state of unconstrained cognition. That's scientific language for a hippie trip. Unconstrained cognition is what those people who die are describing. It's what Jill Bolte Taylor described in her left hemisphere shut down. It's what Eben Alexander described when his frontal cortex was wiped out. It's such powerful evidence that there is much more to mind than matter. Now, this is tricky. I'm still struggling with the implications of this kind of work. But this is an article from Nature, which is very, very respectable science journal. And the article was by Professor Richard Conn-Henry. He's at Johns Hopkins University in the States. And he's passionate about this. I've corresponded with him. He's really upset that this article was published when? 2005. Nobody took any notice of it. They just can't understand it. But so that's kind of 10 years ago. But he teaches all his students. He's a professor of astronomy and mathematics, I think it is, at Johns Hopkins. And he teaches all his students, look, you will not understand the world as long as you think that the world is material. The world is mental. He's saying very much the same as the quantum theorists that I quoted, Max Planck and those others. The subtitle to this paper, The Only Reality is Mind and Observations. But observations are not of things. To see the universe as it really is, we must abandon our tendency to conceptualize observations as things. So when consciousness collapses the wave function and brings into being a particle, what he's saying is that it's only an appearance. Consciousness has created an appearance of a particle, like the computer that creates the appearance of a tennis ball in a virtual tennis game. You know, in a virtual reality tennis game. It's the computer that's created that image. You play around with it with your joysticks. But it's not real. It's actually, its reality lies in the deep computing that has brought it into being. He's saying pretty much the same. And he says he's really very confident that this is the case. Here's a quote. He's a professor of physics and astronomy, sorry, not mathematics. It's not matter that creates an illusion of consciousness, but consciousness that creates an illusion of matter. That is correct physics. It's not controversial in the slightest degree that there is no material reality. This has been demonstrated in both theory and experiment, and he gives references in his paper, which I followed up, and I find them hard to follow, but it seems as if this really is the case, and nobody is coming back to him to argue with him. They're just kind of, like they did with Max Planck and those early quantum pioneers, they're just ignoring the implications of quantum mechanics. And yet, this is Richard Henry again, and yet in how many physics classes today are students made aware of this most fundamental discovery? The illusion of matter, which is to say the illusion of a really existing world, is so strong, I think most scientists are unable to overcome it. Very, very interesting and challenging statement. Now, just a little bit in support. Ant told me that you shouldn't put more than 6 words on a PowerPoint slide, but because of my English and my lack of Hindi, I've put up more, just so that I can read through it to you, because it's so important that this Google pioneer, he's a software engineer, but one of the creators of Google. There's a TED talk by him. I think it's a TED talk. Anyway, it's up on YouTube. He's so clear in support of what Professor Henry has said. The mathematics of quantum information theory tell us unambiguously that particles are not real. We're not physical entities, but informational ones. We're not made of atoms. We're made of quantum bits. What we usually call reality is really a very high-quality simulation running on a quantum computer. This is a very counterintuitive view of the world, but the maths of quantum mechanics tell us unambiguously that it's correct, just as the maths of relativity tell us that there is no absolute time and space. Enlightening as this new insight may be, it does leave us with the vexing question, if what we perceive as reality is only an illusion, what is the substrate for this illusion? If reality is a magic trick, who is the audience? Well, I think you've been hearing some answers to those questions during this retreat. Let's see what we've got here. Well, yes, first I'll just come back to Donald Hoffman. I mentioned him earlier. He's Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of California at Irvine. This is the paper that Rudolf Tanzi and Deepak Chopra referred to in Mind and Matter, 2008. It's a very substantial paper, quite hard to follow, extremely interesting from the point of view of an elaboration of a new scientific theory which he claims is completely testable. So it's a genuine scientific theory. It's not like a revelation which you take or leave, you find that it's useful to you, you use it. But this is science, he's claiming. And he begins his paper, despite substantial efforts by many researchers, we still have no scientific theory of how brain activity can create or be conscious experience. This is troubling because we have a large body of correlations between brain activity and consciousness, correlations normally assumed to entail that brain activity creates conscious experience. So, for example, there are those correlations. There are things like anesthetics that make me seemingly unconscious. There are drugs that I can take that change my consciousness. But what he's saying is that this is actually all appearance, and that really we're living in this virtual reality world, which is, and he compares it to a computer desktop, where you might have a mouse that takes the little arrow on, clicks on one of the icons, drops it into the rubbish bin to remove it, and you think that you've moved it from A to B and that it's disappeared. Actually, you've done no such thing. What has happened is that you've clicked here. That, and then the movement of the mouse has been, the software programmers have engineered it such that the beautiful program behind the scenes actually does the job of removing that icon from the desktop and drops it in the recycle bin. It's just a metaphor, but he's saying that really when we think that we are doing things here in this material world, it's rather similar. There's a deep program, that, like Ron Garrett was saying, that there's a deep quantum, possibly a quantum computer that runs this show, which is far more intelligent and far more intricate than anything that we have ever yet come up with. Even though we can put the whole of the Encyclopedia Britannica onto a memory stick, we think we're clever, but that's nothing compared with nature. This MUI, his multimodal user interface, this is his theory, does not claim that everything we see is unreal, but it says that all sensory perceptions are real in the sense that headaches are real. They exist, but they're observer-dependent. You bring them into being. They exist so long as they are experienced. What one gives up in this framework of thinking is the belief that physical objects and their properties exist independently of the conscious agents that perceive them. Now, that will definitely, if you've taken that in, it will definitely raise some big questions for you, but I'm not in that much of a position to answer them. But this, I thought, was a particularly interesting quote from this leading scientist in the States. Consciousness has always been fundamental and matter derivative. That's what the quantum theorists are telling us. The picture of an evolving, unconscious universe, in other words, blind fate, bringing things out of nothing, billions of years of chance developments ending up with us, the picture of an evolving, unconscious universe of space-time, matter and fields that over billions of years fitfully gives birth first to life, then to consciousness, is false. That is a challenge from a top scientist to all the thinking that makes it so difficult to accept what the Brahma Kumaris have been telling us for 80 years, that we live in a drama that is predestined, that it's like a script, and we play our parts within it, we contribute to the unfolding of it, but it's actually, we're part of of nature's plan. It's not that we're not the big players on the stage that we've assumed ourselves to be. This makes a huge difference to the way you think about yourself, and consequently your experience of life also changes hugely when you start to take this kind of understanding on board. You see, all of this really just demonstrates the scientific basis for prayer, meditation, reflective practice. What you're doing and there are many studies that have been coming forward in recent years that demonstrate beneficial health effects, beneficial effects on brain function, beneficial effects in so many different ways. Why? Because what we're doing is, when we switch off like that and go into silence, we are enabling ourselves to experience that deeper reality. That deeper reality of love and peace and unlimited wisdom, which then informs our limited life. This is an incredibly important thing to do in your life. It's changed to understand that what you're doing is scientific. It's not imagination. It's not just something that feels nice or even just that works in your life. It is actually substantially correct. Eben Alexander, love, without a doubt, is the basis of everything. That he came through so strongly with that theory, and I think he's right, because I think that ultimately there's an expression that consciousness is unitive. This drama, this play that you've been hearing about, that we're all in, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has a kind of purpose to it. It has a structure to it. We think that we're messing it up, but we're not. We're just doing what we have to within it. When you understand that, it brings a tremendous amount of peace to you. And that peace then allows you more access to that beautiful realm that lies beyond. Then you get more information that makes your life even better, makes you even more loving, makes you even more able to contribute well to others. This was from a beautiful book written some years back in the States by Marianne Williamson. The perfect you is the love within you. Closing our hearts, which happens when we come into physical consciousness because we become defensive and narrow and crabby, closing our hearts destroys our peace. It's alien to our nature. Because thought is the creative level of things, changing our minds is the ultimate personal empowerment. And that is the speciality of the Brahma Kumaris. It's helping us to change our minds. Professor Henry, you might say, well, what's all this got to do with God? Well, that remains to be seen, but Henry says, surely it's time for all of us scientists to consider returning to God. Now, he may not have the same understanding of God, the very precise understanding that's taught here. There's a difference between God as a kind of supreme conscious agent and the mind of nature, which has brought us all of the things that the whole drama contains. But nevertheless, it's such an interesting time, isn't it, that scientists themselves are saying, as this leading professor says, surely we should consider returning to God. I think that this is really the power that will bring a better future. We're in the future of power retreat. I think this is the power. This is the power. This is the soft power, as Nizar refers to it. The power of understanding, the power of a deep shift. I am not my brain. I am not my body. I am something deeper than that. And that I can renew myself and my awareness of that when I connect to that supreme being who holds all the truth inside himself. That's what I've learned over these years. It took me a long time to grasp, actually, because of my materialist scientific conditioning in my brain. But I'm particularly passionate about these findings from frontier science because they've helped liberate me so that I can now say, yes, from having been a real out-and-out atheist, I now feel I understand who that supreme being is and I know how to keep that one with me. I forget all the time, but I know that I can do that. So that's the essence of what I wanted to share. And I think there's maybe time for one or two questions. We started about 10 minutes late, so if there are any questions, I'd welcome them. Anyone like to? Yes. If we say that a person is... Yes, thanks.
So many times we say that this person has a black tongue.
Has a black...
Tongue. That's what...
Black
tongue.
Cloud.
Black tongue. Tongue.
A black tongue. I hadn't heard that expression,
yeah.
Sorry.
But what it means is that whatever bad things he says, those things actually happen. So is it that that person is generating all such thoughts in his mind that...
You mean
that
in your mind?
Yeah. With person who says it, is it that he's generating negative thoughts and making those situations happen?
Yes, except that in Raja Yoga, one of the beautiful, empowering things we've learned is that we don't have to allow some black influence to reach us. That's really the empowerment that comes from these deep understandings. Yes, people, if they are in a very empty state internally because of being so locked into matter that they're like orphans. They never feel the love of the Supreme. Perhaps they've had harsh experiences in this life as well that have programmed them into this negativity. And they see negativity everywhere and they're only critical in their outlook. But you don't have to be... It's true that that comes out from them. But one of the beauties of Raja Yoga is it teaches us how to deal with that. You know, like a martial arts expert who doesn't confront an energy that comes at him, but just sidesteps it so that the energy just dissipates. We can do the same when we understand, as you've been hearing, especially from Sister Shivani, that we see others, we know that that's not their truth. We know that that's just a condition that they're in at the moment because of their unhappiness. The black tongue is a reflection of the black thoughts that are inside, but we have to feel sorry for them, not that they're an enemy. And we can do that when we realize that behind the blackness is that beautiful soul. They are a child of God, the same as us. They're a conscious agent as well, same as you and I. But when you recognize that, and make a good practice of it, you start to get this power that you can withstand that blackness and it doesn't touch you. That's what the great yogis do. I'm not there myself, but I'm so much better than I was. And in the office, I came across this halfway through my career as a journalist, and I was quite ego-driven, really, before, which made me work hard, but not be such a good colleague because I'd go up and down all the time. then in the second half of my career, when I learned how to nourish myself, started to learn how to nourish myself with these beautiful thoughts and feelings of and the power from another dimension, I changed immediately, actually, in relation to work colleagues. Much less prickly, much better able to be considerate towards others, much better able to see if someone was in a black mood, it'll pass, you know. Strength came to me immediately. But then it's a question of you gradually build on that over the years.
This is all about future of power, and I'm so glad that the organizers have thought of this very important aspect to be included in this. There's a World Futurist Society which does the lot many exercises, most of the time for the material science, like the future of biotechnology or IT and so on. But what I wanted to share with you is that one of the exercises now has concluded with this, that there would be a merger of science and spirituality in another 20 years.
Great. I'm so happy to hear that. I think it's really coming. We're on the brink of a new scientific revolution, definitely. And it is a revolution, which is why there's a lot of resistance to it from scientists who are programmed materialistically. But it's happening. It's definitely happening. Did I tell you that there was a conference 2 or 3 years ago in Tucson, Arizona? I don't think I did, but they issued what they call a manifesto for a post-materialist science. They said there's so much data now demonstrating that materialist science is limited that we need a post-materialist science. It's unscientific not to recognise that. This was what their manifesto said. So it's very encouraging to hear that that's happening, that science and spirituality are going to meet, but it'll take a little time still because there's a lot of resistance.
Sir, I had read a book long back, The Seat of the Soul, and in which the author had described that the divine intelligence is in the heart.
I think that's actually pretty good. The heart can be understood I would say that the divine intelligence is in the soul, but the soul expresses itself through different aspects of our physical makeup. Heart, left hemisphere, right hemisphere, different aspects of our being. And definitely it seems that the heart is a powerful means of generating those warm feelings that we feel from someone like Daddy Janki. She says everything begins in the heart. Even though she's soul conscious and God conscious, in human terms, she feels that it's the heart that generates the bhavna, which others feel so beautifully from her. So this is a very interesting aspect too.
Yes, sir. I'm very much moved and touched by your speech and the facts. But if I tell you very sincerely, I'm also very much confused. As you said, the consciousness does not die even after the death of the body and the mind.
Of the body and the brain.
Brain. Where that consciousness exists?
Yes.
This is my question.
Where does it exist? Yeah. The question is difficult for me to answer because we are so attuned to this world of space-time, which has the dimension of time and then the three dimensions of space. So where implies somewhere within space-time. And it doesn't exist within space-time. It's outside space-time. The way that the Brahma Kumaris refer to it is the soul world. They speak of it being beyond. You know, they talk of it being up there. That's a manner of speaking because up implies a dimension in a sense. But it's what they mean by that is that it's outside this space-time. And the Pim van Lommel, who did that consciousness beyond life study based on the near-death experience research, he refers to it as non-local space, which is a term used quite commonly among the scientists who are interested in this new way of thinking. But non-local space, you can't say it's here or there or there. It's more like no space. It's nowhere. It is nowhere. It's just the ground of being. That is what consciousness is. The ground of being, and from consciousness, this world of space-time is projected. This, the nature has provided this universe for us to experience ourselves.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have a decision to make. And actually, I'm going to make it for you. We could, I sense in the room a certain frisson, a certain buzz, because our dear brother Neville has been sharing some amazing things. And of course this, you know, I have breakfast with him every morning. Believe me, he can go on a lot longer.
Yeah. Coffee time, in other words.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's so much we could say, but at least you've had a flavor, because you've been hearing from people without the scientific background about things that are spiritual and strange. And then what Neville has done is connected to science, and you're going, wow, there's something here. This is really worth investigating and experiencing and thinking about. And actually, that's the purpose of... So good, well done. You've done
Thank
a very
you.
Good job, because
Thank you.
He's got us going, huh? So...